Sir Alexander Glenreal Fall.
Watson, Wharton, and Appleton went to Tromsø as young radio electronic engineers in 1933, I think, and carried out what must have been the first ionosphere research in high latitudes for 8 months. When we were planning in 1935 to go, or 1934 rather, the year later, started planning to go to Northeast Land, which is about 80 degrees north, a little bit more than that, and very considerably north of the magnetic belt of maximum intensity. Appleton suggested that we should undertake a 12-month ionosphere program, and the Royal Society financed that, and the sets were built at the Radio Research Station at Slough, and part of them also in the Oxford University Laboratories. Watman, then Captain Watman of the Royal Signals, was appointed in charge of that with an Oxford physicist, Richard Hamilton. And that program in 35-36 was in fact carried out with effectively total success. So it was a build-up of that on the record, recordings of the continuous recordings of the varying reflecting layers, then at that time known as the Appleton Heaviside layers, which constituted the groundwork on which the later wartime program was planned and effected.
Where is Northeast Land?
Northeast Land is the easternmost island of the Spitsbergen group, between really Spitsbergen and Franz Josef Land. It's heavily glaciated, not very high, about the size of Wales, and up to 1935-36 had been relatively little known. And it was absolutely ideal for our various purposes. It's also got a rather nice phenomenon of half its ice sheet, which is about the size of Surrey and Hampshire, I suppose, put together, every 100 years slides into the sea rather suddenly, because in fact, like the icing of a cake, the cake underneath has a northeast to southwest rock edge of 500, 600 meters in height. And the accumulation of snow and ice on the top just gets too much. And periodicity of that seems to be about 100 years. It did a slide when we were there. The front, I mean, it moved over probably 48 hours, something like 15, 16 miles into the sea. And there's great excitement at the present time because it's due to do it pretty soon again.
Must have been an incredibly impressive sight.
Well, we never saw it, unfortunately. We crossed it literally about a week before it did it, and we were on the other side of the island. I wish we had seen it. The scientists, Cambridge scientists, sort of perched to go and watch it any time in the next 4 or 5 years. But it's certainly going to happen again.
Did you get to know Watson Watt?
No, I didn't. Appleton, yes. I met at Watson Watt, I think, once or twice, but to know, no. But Appleton really took over, it was he we worked with, put it that way.
What kind of a chap was he?
Oh, marvellous chap. Oh, tremendous enthusiast and a tremendous helper. Very unspoilt, a very straightforward, simple, just nice, very nice man. And we continued to be, you know, really continued, we kept in touch until he died.
Now, if we can link up with the narrative again, because I think you leave the Arctic now for the Balkans again.
That's right, I think, isn't it? One little bit. No, it does follow. Okay.
Yes.
Shall I call this three?
Please.
Back from Spitsbergen, finally, after Tim Healy's death, end September, early October 1942. We'd hatched a small plan by that time. Because of the effect these torpedo bombers were having on the convoys, would it be possible to have a go at the aerial torpedo store at Banach? Admiralty moved us over to Combined Operations Headquarters for that. I was given a pretty free range of options. SIS were extremely helpful. They had someone in the Banach area. I think that's probably true. And so we decided to have a small party of four Canadian Indians and four Norwegians to be taken by Catalina, keeping the sort of family connections together again, if I might put it that way. We all knew each other and trusted each other. To be landed just north of Hammerfest at a little inlet called Repsbottom, which would have meant about a 60-mile journey over that nasty, difficult country, because it's very up and down, very rugged, dropping down the other side into Laxelv, immediately above Banach Airport. The agent's report was that the torpedoes were stored in an easily accessible warehouse, hangar thing. There were reported to be no dogs. And then, if we had blown them, we were going to make return journey 150 miles across Swedish Norwegian Lapland into Sweden. We trained on Ben McDuey Christmas from about, I suppose, end November onwards. Not very successfully, because the Norwegians were skiers and the Canadian Indians, of course, were snowshoe men. And they both were very snooty about each other's techniques. And the Canadian Indians were the most super poachers. I mean, they took everything out of all the local landowners, frozen rivers and everything else. I don't think we were particularly popular there. And I must admit, I was jolly glad when the operation was called off, because, of course, the Banach force were then ordered to the Mediterranean against the Algiers landing. So it was aborted. For years I wanted to go back and, you know, run the route. My guess would be we had a fair chance of doing it. I don't think we would ever have got over to Sweden. I think we would have been picked up and small aircraft, helicopter, whatever, you know. So that was aborted. But it did, of course, occupy from return to Spitsbergen to final call, I suppose. We cleared that up about March 1943.
What's the exact location of Banach?
Right at the peak. Let me show you.
So you've shown me it on the map, and it's to the east of Tromsø in the North Cape area.
That's right. Good. Next few months spent in the Admiralty, and also with Coastal Command, in trying to assess practicability of a Danube mine laying operation. I should add the great encouragement from Sir John Slessor, just taken over command of Coastal. He was very conscious of the Danube's importance. HMS Vernon were developing mining types, design, etc., very imaginatively. And Admiral Sir John Cunningham either had gone or was due to go as Commander-in-Chief Eastern Mediterranean, and he again believed that the Danube, as a major supply route for Germany, must not be neglected. HMS Vernon, I should add, you probably know this, Admiral Poland, with an editorial team, Morgan Giles, who was later in the Adriatic, Roger Lewis, who was torpedo officer to the Mediterranean fleet, they are publishing very shortly official publication of the mining and torpedo operations of World War II. You probably know this, do you?
I had heard through the grapevine.
Yeah. It's the book is the book, the text is completed, has been boiled down, and I think historically we've underestimated enormously the damages inflicted by mining and by the torpedoman. And I think this is going to be quite an important book when it comes out. Well, because the main problem was the logistic one of what could the aircraft carry. We'd very little practical experience go by on mining. As long as it was North Africa, Derna as the nearest, the load, say, in a Wellington or even in a Liberator, looked just too small, whichever way you played it, because here this was going to be free-dropping, probably from 500, 400 feet at night. An awful lot of bits of water around, lakes which aren't the river, etc., etc., etc. And so it was a kind of... In a way, it was a non-productive period. But once we got, of course, the Italian bases with Foggia, 6 months later, the work done in that period was really turned to jolly good use. So I don't regret it at all. It might have been perhaps about the biggest input that any of us made, because Roger certainly, in Vernon's manufacturing design capacity, they produced an extraordinary range of very unpleasant delayed action, chain mining, rather similar, in fact, to, in a very simple way, to what Air Force used in Iraq, of small mines linked over a long period, because with a shallow river, you didn't need one big thing going off in one. And anyway, this, as I say, at the time, rather frustrating 6 months, ended, I guess, about October 43, with my being sent to Albania. This was a pure deception job at that moment when, if you remember, there was quite a big deception program of persuading Hitler in particular that a Balkan invasion was on the cards. We were established by that time at Bari, of course. Foggia was open. And I think the real idea was that one was sent in to do beach surveys, beach reconnaissances, gradients and all that. I think the hope was that we would be picked up by the Germans, just sort of in the middle of doing that, to see as convincing evidence. Very suspicious of motive, because otherwise, in Albania, I mean, my contribution was absolutely zero. We went into a mad chap who called Field. On the first night, we lived in a cave. The sort of random shooting in the morning, the panic. This was just, Field said, two or three Albanians appeared. I will shoot at them. he blew himself up fishing, and so he was replaced then by Anthony Quayle. who was a delightful companion. I mean, and Anthony stayed on. We had the little incident of the 12, of, I think it was 18 actually, US nurses whose aircraft got off course. Rings a bell?
I've heard about it.
Yeah. And they landed finally near Lake Ockrid. And British mission after British mission, again, all these missions, not with the Albanian partisans, really moved these girls on. The German Society, they were quite a prestige capture, so they put quite an effort. I mean, not big, but I mean, they did. Tried to get them out by air once or twice, and each time it was frustrated. They moved them finally to us, because we were the coastal point, and we gave them a tremendous feast in our cave. Got them out the next morning by MTB, and it was quite amusing because they were all clustered. It was a lovely day, and they were all clustered on the foredeck. And the destroyers came out from Barry Harbour, and you saw the glasses sort of turn on this. And bow wave absolutely shot up, you know, like that. And signal came across, what do you think you are doing? And we had great joy in replying, proceeding under most secret orders. That, I think, was a limit of activity.
I understand these girls came to no harm.
They were super. They were magnificent. I mean, they'd done 200 miles or so, hard walking. Legs were torn to pieces. Fingernails, lipstick, looked as if they were walking down some Fifth Avenue. They were a very super lot of extremely brave girls.
Plucky.
They really were. But going on from after I left, Terry Quayle was given two major deception targets. And I might just mention them, because in his book, which was published last year, the tragic thing was he was a very careful compiler, and he wrote this book very, very slowly, rechecking back. And he just finished the wartime part when totally unexpected cancer, and he was dead in four, he was given 4 months. So the whole of the Stratford period and theatre period, post-war, he could not complete. But the wartime part is very complete. It's worth a read, because his is another instance of, I mean, really appalling treatment of him and those with him by SOE Albanian section in Bari. Read it for yourself. And it tallies so closely with really what Michael Lees and the Archie Jack suffered from too, which I think in Michael's case has turned him into the very embittered man he is today. And Archie, I think, too, because, you know, saying, and his refusal ever to come back here is odd. I mean, there's a deep hurt somewhere there. But Tony Quayle's case, again, first hand, and he's gone over. We again continue to see a lot of each other. This was exactly the same pattern. We're not interested in you at all, and don't waste our time. To hell with you, you know.
Who do you think was at fault there?
I don't know. This bit I can't understand. And take the, if you like, the devious Klugman, or the clever Basil Davidson, or and surely you would do exactly the opposite, wouldn't you? You would nourish, be nice to. I don't understand it.
This raises what we were saying earlier off record, if we can put it on the record now, of a question I asked you earlier, which was your own personal contact with James Klugman.
Certainly.
How it came about and what your opinion of him was.
This is a good moment to actually chronologically to take it, because this was my first visit to Bari and first contact with SOE Cairo, now re-established as SOE Bari. Well, remember again throughout that I was an Admiralty body. I, by that time, was responsible to CNC Mediterranean. And when I went back, just probably better to add, later to Yugoslavia, as CNC Med's personal representative with, firstly, the Partisans and Red Army, if, should I meet them. So I had independent status, and I was outside, if you like, SOE politics, machinations, or ambitions. Starting with the people I knew, I suppose Basil Davidson was the first. Enolds had been in Yugoslavia before. James Miller of SIS I'd known, funnily enough, since a child in Scotland. And so that went back a long, long time. More senior people, SOE, like Phil McPherson, again, I'd known from Scottish days. Lord Harcourt had just arrived. I didn't know him before. Now let's just fit in the chronology carefully, because when I was sent to Bari for the purpose of this Albanian mission, it took a little time to arrange transport to Albania. So I was working first day with Morgan Giles to get the seaborne, help get the seaborne traffic organized, and particularly to obtain weapons from the Italian army, Italian regiments in the Bari Brindisi area, which they mostly, quite frankly, provided with, you might say, great relief, and it was not drawing teeth at all. But we did that on quite an extensive scale. Another RNR officer, Webb, Morgan Giles, myself, and we would literally just drive round, go to, and say, what can you let us have? Then that intervened with a report that Fitzroy McLean's wireless had gone dead. Could we get a set over to him that he was trying to reach the island of Korchula and make a blind meeting for Korchula. Korchula was supposed to be held by the Germans, and so MTB took us over. We did a night landing. There wasn't a German in the place, by the way. But timing was absolutely providential, because McLean and his party had just arrived the evening before, delivered radio set to him, and then spent, we kept the MTB heavily camouflaged in one of the little creeks. Fieser storks were flying pretty frequently overhead, and one or two the flying birds, and she was never run board. But the German attack to drive the partisans off the coast had started, particularly up the long Peliasats Peninsula, just inside Korchula. And that was real mountain ridge fighting, and the 1st Alpine were working along. And partisans were holding on, I mean, every crag, and they, if doubts expressed, did the partisans fight the Germans? All I can say is that if any troops had fought the Germans as hard as that bit was concerned, the partisans did fight, and did fight with effect. It was a nasty, many wounded and many killed. What is Bellisats? 1,500 feet, I suppose, the ridge height from the sea. It might be a wee bit more. And very abrupt, you know, falling down steeply on both sides. Very little cover, mortar, great use of mortars, and just hand engagement. That lasted, I suppose, for a week. Then McLean returned inland to rejoin Tito, and we took the MTB back. So it was, although short in time, it was quite a, it was a very interesting sort of first-hand view of a Dalmatian unit, partisan competence. I was very impressed. Very impressed indeed. Then into Albania, and taking over MTB, as I told you, really my time there, we achieved absolute damn all. It personally had the personal great pleasure of Anthony Quayle's company in the NATO stage. But then the rather sad story, which I explained to you later. Well, coming back to the SOE, structure there. I think I do this from hindsight today, thinking back, and I'm trying to repeat faithfully what I said this morning. I think David Martin, for example, oversimplifies and exaggerates James Klugman's role. I saw a good bit of Klugman in Bari. I found him an agreeable, okay?
Yes.
I think I'd just like to extend that, though, into our trying to have a look at SOE as a whole, this strange, rather baffling organization. SOE London, 1941-42, I found pretty normal. I didn't want to belong to them, but not for any specific reason against SOE, because much more because I didn't want to get caught up in the infighting between Baker Street and Broadway. And Charles Hambro I knew well, George Taylor, who I think was deputy to him at that time, and as I think I indicated before, I had had very happy relations with SOE over Norwegian section, over Spitsbergen, and Norway.